John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show on CBS Audio Network. David Livingston, Dr. Space, joins me. This is Hotel Mars Episode N. David hosts the space show each week, conversing about engineering and discoveries in outer space. Well, the big one we can all see, especially during the times of the full moon and supermoon, which we've lived through, is the lunar surface, the space race of the 1960s. Here we are in the 21st century. And the announcement of a colony on the moon is not from America. It's from the Russian Federation and the People's Republic of China. So we thought immediately we go to the man who's already anticipated all the problems, all the exceptions, all the grants, all the doubts about building a colony on the moon or beyond. Professor Chaim Ben-Arroya of Rutgers University, who's the author of several books that speak to this matter. It's been a privilege and a pleasure to speak to Chaim over the years about his books. One, Building Habitats on the Moon. Another, Turning Dust into Gold. Another, Lunar Settlements. They all describe the moving story of the technology and the expectations of a lunar colony. Professor, a very good evening to you. I go to the press release from Russia. I don't have the Chinese press release, but they are conjoined, so we can believe that this informs. Russia says that it wants a station, an international scientific lunar station, for a, complex of experimental research facilities created on the surface and or in the orbit of the moon, designed to carry out multidisciplinary and multipurpose research work. So they're presenting this as a scientific endeavor. But first they have to live there. To your understanding, Professor, does Russia, does China, do they have the technology, the engineering, and the booster lift to transport modules that human beings can live in for time on the surface or under the surface of the moon? Good evening to you.
Good evening. Thank you for having me on your show. I would say that both countries, the Russians and the Chinese, are in the process of building that technology. They don't have the same heavy lift that we do, but they're definitely working very hard to get it. Their Long March 8 rocket has a lift capability of 8.4 metric tons to low Earth orbit. By comparison, Starship will have a capacity of 100 metric tons. Now, both the countries, as you said, are planning to be on the moon independently and together through their recent agreement. The Chinese would like to have a presence on the moon by 2036. And the Russians want to have a lunar orbiter by 2025, eventually leading to a base around 2040. So they're looking very far ahead. And my belief is that based on what they've done in the past and what they're doing now, especially now with the Chinese capability with Mars, the technology is there. I would add, however, that putting technology on the moon or Mars is an order of magnitude easier than putting people on the moon or Mars, especially Mars, because of the long flight time. So we'll see how much they do with people. Once we see them doing what we did in Apollo, sending manned missions around the moon, orbiting, landing, then I would say that they're very close to doing what they're promising to do.
David?
Good afternoon, Chaim. In the past, Russia and Chinese have had a lot to say and talked about their joint ventures and what they're going to do, but they don't accomplish much together. Do you think this time they're actually going to be able to work together to accomplish these broad goals that they're writing about right now and that are in the memorandum of understanding?
I would say we have to wait and see. I think that what stimulated their activity were our Artemis Accords. The Russians and the Chinese are very worried that our companies such as SpaceX, Blue Origin, other companies, that our private enterprise system will be able to marshal the resources and the focus necessary to actually get people to the moon and to Mars eventually. Maybe they're a little bit less worried about NASA, because NASA has had a lot of starts and stops, and NASA is obviously dependent on the political will of those in Washington, whereas SpaceX, Blue Origin, at some point, will become autonomous and will be able to do what they want to do.
Chaim, why the South Pole? What is it?
So the South Pole, over the past couple of decades, via different orbiters and impactors, we found that potentially there are huge amounts of water in the form of water ice under the surface there. And so the water is critical for everything we do, and because we can break it apart into hydrogen and oxygen. Oxygen, obviously, for breathing, but both hydrogen and oxygen are critical for liquid fuel. And being on the moon would give anybody a tremendous advantage to do anything in space, anything from low Earth orbit all the way out to Mars and beyond. The multiple of launching from the moon is about 1/20th it would be from Earth. So if we have bases on the moon that can mine the regolith and extract various elements, including hydrogen and oxygen, then we can use the moon as a base of operations almost for the whole solar system.
David?
Many people are in the United States are concerned about what China may be doing, maybe a little less concerned about Russia. From what you know about this, is there anything about it that worries us here in the United States, or is competition healthy?
Well, competition is both healthy and worrisome with respect to the Chinese in particular, because while they will do a lot of science, and I'm sure good science, it's basically a geopolitical decision to go back to the moon and mine the moon. They basically see a future space economy that has possible returns in the trillions of dollars. The mining of the moon is not just for oxygen and hydrogen and things like that, but there are also a lot of rare earths and helium-3. So they see the moon as a place for mining and creating wealth. And it gives them also the high ground of space has military implications. And even though, you know, we're supposed to follow the rules of demilitarizing space, it's really the opposite that's happening, and one has to worry about that.
Professor, what are the risks for the surface of the moon and for underneath the lunar surface for human beings?
So the surface of the moon is basically a carcinogenic landmine for humans and for machines. For humans, the regolith is extremely fine. It has been pummeled by endless meteorites, and we saw from the Apollo that the astronauts breathed it in. They brought it into their space capsule. The regolith jammed all their machinery. They were lucky that they were still able to do at least part of what they were hoping to do. So the regolith is one of the critical aspects that has to be resolved. In fact, the regolith is the number one item that determines how long a rover or a piece of equipment based on solar power will survive, because eventually that regolith just covers the solar power, the solar panels, and no more power. So the regolith is the number one issue. The second, I would say, is radiation. So radiation effects on people, we know more about that. We know about the radiation effects on electronics, on different kinds of materials. From the purely human perspective, the low gravity on the moon is a critical issue that is pretty much unresolved. We don't know how well people will survive for how long in a 1/6 G environment. In space, for example, you can rotate the spacecraft to create an artificial gravity, but you can't do that on a planetary surface. You need to figure out, what do you do with a human body when the low gravity effects start taking hold? We see some of that in the space station. We don't have a resolution for that. And that's, from the human point of view, that's probably the key issue for us to understand.
And under the surface, are there additional risks? Because I can imagine tunneling as a way to secure yourself from the dangers of the surface, including micrometeorites.
That's right. You point to a very important potential. One would think that most of our habitats on the moon will be underground eventually. And the discovery of lava tubes within the moon are actually quite hopeful from that point of view. They're very large. They could be hundreds of meters in diameter. They can extend for miles under the surface. And once you're maybe 100 meters under the ground, as these lava tubes generally are, or even deeper, you're basically immune from micrometeorites. You're immune from large temperature gradients. You're immune from the radiation. So being underground solves a lot of your problems. It doesn't solve the regolith problem. It doesn't solve the low gravity problem. But it solves a good number of problems that on the surface we're really subject to.
David?
Are you seeing an increase in lunar engineering proposals and lunar activity in the academic lunar engineering community. Is it gearing up for these challenges?
Well, it's interesting you ask that, because this semester I'm teaching a course on lunar habitats, which goes beyond just the structures. It goes to all the issues that we've been discussing so far, everything from the environment, which is deadly to humans and machines, and how do you deal with it? What are the technologies that are being developed? And this class of over 30 students, both seniors and graduate students, are super enthusiastic and passionate about space. A few of them have worked and will continue to work at some of these companies that we just mentioned. So I think that across the U.S., there are people who are starting to teach courses in this in these disciplines because they're, I think, the sight of private enterprise stepping into this, as we've seen over the past decade, I think that gives us hope in the sense that we don't always have to depend on the taxpayer, that maybe companies will be able to use the good aspects of capitalism to create incentives and look for opportunities, and then basically by the created wealth pay for all these very expensive activities.
We're speaking with Chaim Ben-Arroya, professor at Rutgers University, but most importantly, the author of a series of books about lunar and other planets, surface and underground, under soil, habitats. The major book to hear is Building Habitats on the Moon, Turning Dust into Gold, and Lunar Settlements. When we come back, we're going to ask the professor to look into the future. 100 years from now, 200 years from now, what will a lunar colony look like? Will it be abandoned? Will it look like an old Western mining town that has tumbleweed blowing through it? Or will it look like Las Vegas? David Livingston, Dr. Space of The Space Show. I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show, Hotel Mars, Episode N.